This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Take it easy today. Going to sip some wine with Joe Campanelle, who is, I don't know, are you the youngest master sommelier in the country right now?
Wow, I wish that were true. I'm not even a master sommelier.
Soon to be. I can feel it. I'm projecting this on you.
Thank you. I'll take that unwarranted projection.
Well, you are a wine wonder kid. I mean, how old are you? 27 years old?
Yeah, I just turned 28. But when I got hired for my first real sommelier job, I just turned 23, and I was working at Babbo at the time.
Fantastic. I mean, you talk about wines maturing and people with palates that have tasted things for, you know, almost a century, decades upon decades. How, in such a short period of time, have you progressed to where you are, and how have you developed your palate? I mean, you're a boy from Queens, right?
That's right. I grew up in Queens, and I don't know if you know this, but Queens is not the land of wine culture. Like, there aren't like a ton. I didn't have a group of like wine tasters.
All the vineyards in Flushing, you know.
Yeah, it's not wine country, despite popular opinion. But no, I got into wine freshman year at college. I'd gone by a local wine store, Union Square Wines, and there was a sign outside that said, "Come in, free wine tasting." And as a freshman in college, I thought that sounded not too bad.
Yeah, what age were you? 18?
Yeah.
this is a trick for all you college freshmen out there that are looking to drink legally. They don't often check IDs at wine tastings.
Now, if you just pretend like you're supposed to be there, then they don't really check. I'd started going to those free tastings so often that by my sophomore year, I was such a regular, they invited me to their Christmas party. It's still the same wine director there, and I talk with him all the time, and I'm like, you know, I was underage at that time. He's like, oh, I had an idea, but you're cool, so it was all right.
Do you remember those first wines you started tasting with them that were those gateway, you know, beverages?
You know, I don't remember some of the first wines, but what I do remember is going to the tastings, seeing people just really enjoying themselves, talking to winemakers, talking to distributors, and just thinking, man, this is a really fun, cool scene, and I really like this, and I want to be part of this. There's something about it that's just really resonating with me.
Yeah, so Queens, not this bountiful place of grapes. There must have been times in your life. What did you grow up eating, drinking? What were your first sips of wine?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was no wine in the house growing up. I grew up with just me and my mom, an only child of a single mom. So times where, you know, we counted every dollar, and there wasn't a lot of leftover. But from an early age, mom did really concentrate on the importance of eating something that's good, and how great it is to be able to go out and enjoy a meal out. So once a week, that's all we could do then. But once a week, we would go and have a meal out. And I just remember how nice it was to sit there and enjoy the time together and be taken care of, and how important, how much we both paid attention to flavors even at that early age. And, you know, she's really into perfume, and we would always smell perfume. As a little boy, smelling perfume. But it's a miracle I'm so masculine now. So I remember like flavors and smells, you know, paying attention to that from an early age. But what really, 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 I think, was important for me developing, which is what I think you're asking about, my palate, is coming to New York, living in the city. I went to NYU and going to farmers markets, and I would go to farmers markets all the time and just smelling all these different herbs, smelling fruits, smelling vegetables, and paying attention to them. I really loved the smell and the sensory experience of smelling everything. And then I was able to, when I tasted those in wines, tasted those same flavors in wines, being able to articulate, because I remembered what something really specific would smell like that maybe I had never been exposed to earlier in my life.
Yeah. I mean, it is all about recall. Do you remember that first recall where you sniffed a wine and you're like, oh, I know exactly what that scent is. That's strawberries. That's, you know, lovage. That's this.
Yeah. I remember being at a restaurant with, this isn't like romantic at all, but I remember being at a restaurant with friends and saying that a wine smelled like tobacco, and mom was a smoker and I hated that growing up. But and the sommelier said, oh, that's a very astute observation. And like being like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. I made an astute observation. And so I kind of love that, being able to pick out something that someone else recognizes as being a valid tasting note. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I mean, because it's intimidating. Wine, you not only have to be able to swirl the glass and not spill it all over yourself, but you have to have some kind of language. And developing that language is such a kind of, I think, thing that people are apprehensive about.
You are so, so right. And what I always tell people is that everyone will drink much better wine and make my job a lot easier, but it's all about everyone else. But if you drink much better wine, if you can figure out just a couple of things to communicate, some really, really simple steps to communicate, that'll help you drink better wine. What color wine do you want? Do you want white, red, rosé, or sparkling? Do you want light-bodied, full-bodied, or medium-bodied? So that's like skim milk, 2%, or heavy cream, right? Do you want it to be fruit-forward or earthy? And then how much do you want to pay? So if you can say something as simple as, I want a full-bodied, fruit-forward red wine for $20, you'll drink much better wine. If you can figure out that simple way to describe. And then once you start getting to that, then you can start to make more distinctions from there.
But I mean, that's like putting you in the top 1% almost of, you know, drinkers around the country, yet alone wine drinkers. That if you can define those four things, you can actually figure out what you want to drink.
Yeah, and I think it's not that hard. You know, if you want white, red, rosé, or sparkling, you know how much you want to pay, and then it's just the body and if you want to be fruit forward or earthy, and it could be a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But you know what, why I really got into wine and to being a sommelier is some of those experiences that I had when I was a kid, eating out with mom, and then eventually when I got my own place, when I went to school, having friends over and wanting to replicate that hospitality experience. And really what I think a sommelier does is uses their knowledge and love of wine to create great moments for people, to create good hospitality for people, to create a special time in someone's life. And that's what I really enjoyed. You know, I know you were in the kitchen for a while.
Yeah.
I loved food before I loved wine. And one of the things, what I really loved about food was cooking for my friends. I cooked for my mom a lot, especially after she got into this really bad accident. I loved cooking and then serving someone and sitting down and enjoying it with them. When I worked in a kitchen, I hated it because I would cook and then I'd never be able to see someone enjoying, like, oh my God, did they like it? Did they not like it? What did they
you
think?
Wait for the plate to come back and see whether or not it's been cleaned.
Not that what I was really doing was, you know, it was like mostly prep, but still, if I had made it up to the point where I was on the line or something, you know, that requires real hard work and talent, I still don't think I would have been as fulfilled as being in the front of house when you can see the feedback, you can make sure that everyone is having a good time, you can see people enjoying themselves and having these really cool moments in their lives.
Yeah, well, I mean, you were saying you went to NYU for undergrad and something percolated there. Because you didn't initially go to the food studies program. You didn't initially think you were going to go abroad and study in Madrid and Florence and, you know, bound about Italy. Is that when you not only learned about food, wine, but hospitality?
That's so true. I grew up in Queens and then went to NYU. And when you grow up in Queens, you're, you know, you're part, at least where I came from in Queens, it feels very much like you're from Queens and you're not part of the city. So I had no idea what was in store for me once I got to NYU and how much my love of food would really blossom. I really thought that I wanted to be a lawyer and then go into politics. I was like, man, it sucks being poor. I'm going to make so much money and be a lawyer. And then I can use this money to do something good. Because in high school, I'd done a lot of volunteering, and I found that to be really, really satisfying. It's like, all right, I'm going to make lots of money, stop being poor, and then do something really good with the world. I still have this really strong desire to give back, and we're constantly... in fact, after this, I'm going to a charity event. But we're doing a lot of that. But I realized at school that I had no desire to be a lawyer whatsoever. And I found myself writing all my papers, whether it was for a literature class or econ class, whatever it was, about food. And I found this food studies program, which was not my major, and I had taken all these electives in food studies and spent all of my time on the electives and none of my time on the important core classes of my major, and something clicked and said, I need to surround myself by food.
Yeah. So in food studies, is there a focus? I mean, you didn't diverge right towards wine at the onset.
That's right. So food studies, it's such a fun program, and I feel a little bit guilty about how much fun I had with it, because it's really, like, you're reading all the books that I would be reading, you know, if in a cafe or on the beach. Like, it's like The Omnivore's Dilemma and Supersize Me, and that's the McDonald's book. Like, all these really interesting, like, state of how we eat and what are the factors that affect what we eat and who's are the important players in that.
I mean, that's all the socio-political stuff that you were hoping to get fulfilled from by being a lawyer, that, you know, I think people gloss over that food can also be food systems, is food systems first and foremost.
That's true. And that program, the food studies program, is becoming even more and more food systems oriented. So it was really the sociology of food, and I love that. But I don't think it gave me a ton of real skills to be in the restaurant industry. So if you want to be in the restaurant industry, don't do the food studies program at NYU.
Yeah, be in the restaurant industry. Yeah, I mean, you worked at Italian Wine Merchants. How did you parlay yourself tasting at Union, you know, Square Wines to a job at a wine store?
Oh, I offered to work for free.
Yeah.
Sometimes that helps. Most time that helps. I walked into Italian Wine Merchants. I had just gotten back from studying in Italy, and I bought a bottle of wine. I was with my best friend. I was like, man, I loved this experience. This is the greatest store. I'd never been in here. This was awesome. And he said, why don't you ask if, you know, you keep talking about, like, wanting to work in wine, and you know, you don't want to work in the kitchen, and why don't you ask them for a job? And I found the manager. I walked up. I said, I've never worked in a wine store. I've taken a couple of wine classes. I'd be happy to work for you for free. I'm still in college. So that was a nice luxury to be able to do that. But, you know, at the expense of increased student loan debt. But yeah. it ended up working out all right.
I mean, but how long were you lifting boxes before you lifted a glass to your lips?
At Italian Wine Merchants? Yeah. Oh, they were so great about opening up a ton of wine. And pretty much right away, I started working as a sommelier and bartender for their private events. And they do these incredible private events in the back.
The space in back is killer.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's beautiful. And the chef there right now, his name is Kevin Sipple. He could run any Italian restaurant in the city right now and do a great job at it. He's an incredibly talented chef. At the end of the night, we'd be left with bottles of, like, Bartolo Mascarello and Giacosa and Paolo Bay, like all of these great, incredible producers. And, you know, I was barely of age to drink and bringing these, like, truly epic wines home to my dorm room.
Yeah.
And so that was really fun.
So you weren't throwing keggers, you were throwing corkers? I don't know what to call those.
I'll leave that one.
So from that International Wine Center, which is an awesome place for wine education here in Manhattan.
That's right. So International Wine Center, it's a wine school on 7th Avenue and 29th Street. And I had taken a class at NYU called Beverages, which was taught by Linda Lowry, who's the president of the International Wine Center. And it approximates their intermediate class. And after the class, she had offered that I do a teacher's assistant for her advanced class, which was great because I really wanted to continue my wine studies. I really enjoyed it. They do something really tricky at NYU, though. They make you take that class at 10 in the morning, so so that everyone has class after and no one's really going after it.
That's smart.
But so I did the advanced class, and I absolutely loved it. I was with people who were in the industry, who were much older than me. And then their top-level class is called Diploma, and I so badly wanted to do the Diploma class, but it was several thousands of dollars and couldn't afford it. But what they offered me was, if I were to work at the wine center, I could do the Diploma class for free. So I left Italian Wine Merchants and worked at the wine center. That was a busy year. I was also an RA and doing master's level classes in food studies with a full course load. So, and I worked at the gym. That's a busy year. I didn't have the typical college.
Yeah, but at the same time, don't you wish you were at that age again when you can do all that at once? And even though you feel exhausted, you don't feel the same kind of exhausted as now.
Yeah.
On that note, we're actually going to take a quick break, and we're going to taste some wine. There's some beautiful bottles here waiting for us to sip. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
All of us at Kane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to Kane5.com.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Joel Campanelli, 28-year-old Psalm. I mean, it's not old in the Psalm world. It's very, very young.
I find that all my friends, top sommeliers in the city, are kind of about my age. It's becoming a younger and younger profession.
Yeah. Talk about young. 23. What was your profession?
So just after, I know what you're implying here. You want me to talk about Babo?
Leading a little bit.
So just after my 23rd birthday, I got hired as a sommelier at Babo Restaurant. It's a killer restaurant, obviously very, very famous and owned by Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich down in the West Village. I feel like I get too much play off of that. I wasn't there very long.
Yeah.
It was just like not too long after I started, I got the opportunity to open up our first restaurant. But it was in that short time, it was an amazing experience. And I learned a ton. It's a great place.
Your first restaurant, now there are how many?
There's one opening up soon. Okay, so now we have two restaurants, Dell'Anima and Lertuzzi, both in the West Village. And then right next to Dell'Anima, we have a wine bar called Amphora.
Which I spend way too much time at. You probably don't think it's way too much time for a patron to be there all the time, but I spend way too much time there. It's awesome. It's just fantastic.
There's nothing wrong with being a regular. We love regulars. Yeah. Being in the restaurant industry has made me appreciate what being a regular means. I was never a regular at any restaurant before opening up our restaurants. And now going back to somewhere and seeing the same faces and really feeling welcomed back and understanding a place, I realize how special that is. Love regulars. Yeah. Come back all the time. We're opening up a new restaurant. It's going to be called La Picho, and it's going to be opening up in a few months, probably early fall.
Yeah.
and down on the Bowery, which when I got to NYU, the Bowery, I still knew, had the Bowery had this reputation of being a really scary, dangerous place. So I remember my heart beating faster when seeing the word Bowery and walking across the street and you know, my step picking up a little bit. Probably that wasn't that justified back then because it was already starting to change. But
it still was a little sketch. Like Tompkins Square Park. Just seeing the conversion of those two areas there. Yeah. Kind of crazy to me.
Tompkins Square, one of the like five parks in the city that were called Needle Park.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, meet me at Needle Park. Which one? There's so many Needle Parks. I know them all.
So you got the Bowery going. But it was 2007. You started Del Anima, and all these are based in Italian heritage. They have an Italian breed to them. But, and I also want to say, your chef partner, Gabe Thompson, is one of the best Italian chefs in the city.
Oh, I could not agree more. Yeah. I don't think we can do anything that we do without Gabe and also our business partner August, who's my boss at Italian Wine Merchants. And actually Gabe's wife as well. She's the pastry chef, but she's the great communicator. She can do anything. Yeah. If we lost a chef de cuisine, a GM, or a pastry chef tomorrow at any of our restaurants, she could jump in and do
it. We should do a whole show about building a team because that core, and you guys call yourself, what, Epicurean?
Epicurean management.
Yeah, is building a team is so overlooked and so important in the restaurant industry. Yeah.
And then I feel like I would be like the Academy Awards where you're just thanking too many people. But
we'll
like,
just start playing the music.
Kevin Gary, who's our general manager, who's our director of operations, and Ron Levine, who's the president of Epicurean, they're like completely invaluable to everything we do. And they've brought a lot of experience that I didn't have. And so I've learned a lot from them as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start tasting wines and still talk about all the restaurants because I go to N4 because it is a wine term, but it's also an absurd collection of wines. What does N4 mean? And don't we have N4 here?
Oh, yeah. Let's start tasting N4 wine. So Anfora was the name was actually inspired by a winemaker, Jasko Grovner from Friuli up in northeastern Italy. He took a trip to Georgia, the country, not the state of Georgia, and he found that the wines there were being made in amphora, which are terracotta clay pots buried in the ground, and they've been made that way for over 8,000 years, consecutive vintages. And he was really inspired. He was already considered one of the best winemakers in Italy, especially white winemakers, and he was inspired to change his entire production and make wine only in amphora clay pots. So I think that what he did was extremely brave. He changed everything that he'd been doing, even though it was proving to be incredibly successful because of something he really believed in. So the first wine that we're tasting, we actually pour by the glass at Amphora, and it is an Amphora-aged wine, but from Georgia. And the grape here is called Chinuri, which is pretty obscure, even in Georgian terms. And I actually visited this winemaker. He has five Amphora clay pots. He's a farmer by all stretch of the imagination, and he only grows Chinuri. Half of it he does it with skin contact, half of it does it without. This one has some skin contact, so you see it's a little deeper golden color. It's a lot of savory notes. It's kind of tannic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I taste the earthiness, but when people hear the word earthy, I think they get so scared shitless. Oh, see, I cursed. They get so scared shitless that they think it's going to taste like mushrooms or leaves, but earthy, I think, better described as savory in this one because, you know, then you instantly think of pairing. This is a beautiful wine to drink alone during the summer, but it definitely goes well with what? And I'm leaving it blank for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's super savory. You know, anytime you have an skin macerated white wine, which you might hear referred to as an orange wine, you get some of the tannins from the skin. So tannins do really well with anytime you have protein. So this is a white wine that you could really even go into some of your more traditional red wine dishes, like especially going to pork and duck and start getting even a little bit further into the meat component.
Cool, yeah, that's a good like little butteriness.
A little butteriness. Yeah. If you have like in the summer, I really like to do like room temperature food or cold food even.
Yeah.
If you're having people over, so like if you were to do like steak and slice it up and like let it be cold and have like an arugula salad or something with it or roasted potatoes, I think that this is a white wine that would be nice kind of with that room temperature steak.
But you also like playing with temps because one of your favorite white wines you serve at red wine temp.
That's right. This one, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is the one.
So a trademark of all of our lists is that I really love to have a white wine served at cellar temp. And that's always going to be a white wine that's made with skin contact, that's made in the style of a red wine. And then a red wine that's served chilled. I like drinking chilled red wine also. It has to be something that's really fresh and young and fruit forward. But I always love that.
Cool. And I think we actually have one here that we might give a shot.
We have red wine.
Yeah.
You can taste some red wine.
Just commenting on the with skin contact sticker that's on this bottle. That's classy. That's awesome.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that's pretty classy. So with skin contact, you know, all white wines used to be made with skin contact, and making fresh, clean, clear, crisp, fruit-forward white wines is somewhat of a modern invention for most of the world. So they're really making wine pretty similar to how it was made 6,000 years ago.
So you know how you had that set of four questions that, you know, are asked and answered. What would you consider that first wine?
That wouldn't fit into any of them. I mean, if you were to go to the first... Yeah, go. Let's pour this one. Yeah. Sorry, that wine, in terms of color, I'd say an orange wine. Full, medium, or light-bodied, probably medium-bodied, fruit-forward or earthy, I guess you'd say savory or earthy. And then the price, it's so reasonably priced. It's like, I mean, it's $42, $44 on the list. And I think we pour it for like $11 or $12 or something like that. So it's a really approachably priced wine. And the other reason we like to have these orange wines by the glass is so that people who haven't had them can at least try them to see if it's something you like. Because it's honestly not for everyone and not for every situation. Yeah. You kind of have to be in the mood for it.
This is, I think, for everyone and most situations.
We're also pouring this by the glass at Amphora. This is the Albert Boxler Riesling from Old Vines, 2007. You know, there's a couple people are participating in the Summer of Riesling this summer. I think that Paul Greco is doing such great work. I think it's so awesome the way he's gone behind this grape. It's definitely a sommelier's favorite. I hope that China never finds out about how good Riesling is with their food and drives up the prices, because, oh my God, Riesling is so good with Chinese food.
Yeah. Riesling. I think I used to always have that hold up, that the lanolin, the almost gasoline smell, but then the sweetness, everything, because it can be dry, it can be off dry, there can be sweet Rieslings. There's such a breath of Riesling, and I think it was defined one way for so long that, you know, having these kind of wines shows that it has so much versatility too.
That's right. This is a pretty dry Riesling, not the driest, but I mean, you see drier and drier, even in regions where it's typically, you know, it's typical to make a sweet Riesling, like in the Mosel Valley. And they're just so versatile. I think it's like it's a trick of a sommelier to bring out a Riesling, because they're undervalued, and because of the acidity, they're super, super versatile.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question about tasting, because that is an intimidating part for me still. Knowing people in the wine industry, I don't feel like I have the knowledge to even go through the process sometimes. How do you taste a wine? There's the swirl, there's the smell, there's this sound, which I'm going to attempt not to dribble all over myself.
Oh yeah.
So I mean,
you know, it depends on the situation. If I was on a date, I would not make that sound.
Yeah.
But if I was sitting for a Master of Wine exam, I'd probably be making a lot of that sound, because what you're doing is you're sucking in air and you're bringing the aromas through your retronasal cavity, and that's really where your sense of smell conveys the flavors to the brain.
And I love things like retronasal
cavity.
That volatilizing the esters, wine terms are also intimidating but gorgeous once you get them down and understand what they mean. But so would you swirl a wine, would you smell a wine and then taste a wine? Is there a progression through all, or is there a different way to taste different wines?
I mean, it depends. For me, it really depends on the situation and the scenario. If I was just to enjoy wine, I'd still swirl it. I would swirl it because it really helps the aromas come out, be a lot more aromatic. But if I was really analyzing the wine, which, you know, if it's a social situation, I'm probably not paying as close attention to the wine, because you want to enjoy it. And the point of wine is for it to be enjoyed. That's its number one purpose in life. But if I was really analyzing it, I would look very closely at the color. The color tells you a lot, from you know, the age. It could tell you the age. Maybe it can hint at the oak aging. It could tell you a lot of different things. Even the climate. If you see green flecks in a white wine, you might think it could be from a cooler climate. Then I would pay a lot of attention to the nose. I would say, is it clean? Is it dirty? Is it off? Is it fruit forward? Is it earthy? The state of the fruit on the nose can tell you if it was from a warm climate, if it's really, really ripe fruit, or cool climate, if you have some vegetal kind of characters. If it's oaked, you can tell a lot. You really, the nose tells you a lot more, which is why you do that retronasal slurpy thing, so that you can get even more of those flavors on your nose. And then on the palate, I think the main thing that I would do, you know, if it was a social setting or you know, a master of wine exam, I just slow down and like let that wine go all over your palate. I think slowing down, paying a little bit more attention to it, is the best trick you can do for a wine tasting, and not overthinking it, but also not just knocking it back. Though there are times for knocking it back.
Yeah, and this one is definitely one of those knock it back kind of wines.
Oh, yeah. So I just got back from Greece.
Is this smuggled no sulfi?
This is not a smuggled no. This is imported and distributed throughout, I believe, the greater United States. Kyriani Rosé from Greece. From all the way up to northern Greece, a grape called Xenomavro, which makes amazing Barolo-like, earthy, savory red wines. And wherever I went in Greece and I asked winemakers, you know, this is we've been pouring this for at Anaphora for a while, and I said, hey guys, I've been pouring the Kyriani Akakis Rosé, and everyone pretty much said that's like the best rosé in Greece. But I found the quality of the wines to be super high, but especially loved the rosés, and then the white wines from Santorini are ridiculous. They're incredible.
So growing up in Queens, and you grew up in Forest Hills, did you go to Astoria? Did you eat at Greek restaurants? And did they have these kind of rosés then?
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry to say that Forest Hills was really provincial for me. We didn't travel far, and we never went to Astoria. I didn't understand what a great bounty of you know, different cuisines Queens is, from Astoria and Jackson Heights and Sunnyside and all over, until getting out of Queens and going to and living in Manhattan and then rediscovering Queens from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, this Kyriani Rosé. Do you like this?
It's going to be on my summer list. Yeah. It's going to be on my winter list. It's going to be on my annual.
See, you know, in the spring, we get all these emails from our distributors. It's rosé time, and people start drinking rosé and ask for rosé. I drink rosé all year round. I don't understand if you drink a white wine in the middle of the winter, why can't you drink a rosé? They're so good, and they're so versatile. And if you're grilling, if you have like a barbecue, rosé is the best because it can go with anything. Rosé and bubbles.
Well, what other... Oh, bubbles. That's a whole nother story. What kind of wine preconceptions are you trying to break down kind of like that about, you know, what to drink when and also, you know, what to pair with what?
I mean, there's so many preconceptions, but I think a lot of people have been doing really good work about breaking down the preconceptions. I mean, the biggest one is that you know, that wine has to be something that's really special and revered and, you know, isn't for everyone. I think that, you know, wine can be the purpose. Like I said before, the purpose of wine is to make your life better and more happy and more enjoyable. So if you take the seriousness out of it and the pretension out of it, which again, I really think that's been going on. Like, you can just have fun with it, and that's the point. That's the point. Drink wines that you really like and have fun with them,
and visit your life those will be places better. Too.
Oh my God, visit those places. That's the greatest trip. I mean, the producers are so happy to welcome you.
Which leads us into our next wine. It's an Etna Rosso, and I was lucky enough to go to Sicily last year and experience the living creature that is Mount Etna and Nerello Mascalese's. And how important is it for you to visit the place, you know, have that terroir experience?
I try to make the case to my business partners that it's so important that I go visit these places, especially the islands that make wine, all the time.
Yeah. Which islands?
Well, I just got back from Santorini, so that was amazing. But, you know, I really do think that visiting the place gives you a greater understanding, a much greater understanding of who's making wine, how they're making wine, what are the factors that are affecting the way the wines taste. And when you can tell a guest about that and give them the full story, the full picture about it, granted, this has to be a guest who's interested because some people aren't interested and that's okay as well. Then you're really enriching their experience. And as I said before, the point of the sommelier is just to provide hospitality through wine knowledge. And if having a little bit more wine knowledge is going to help you and make the guests have a greater time, then that's awesome. But we're on Mount Etna, so the active volcano in Sicily, the largest active volcano in Europe right now. And I think Sicily is the most exciting place in Italy for winemaking right now. There are a ton of native grapes. There are a lot of producers who are doing really exciting winemaking, natural winemaking, like Arianna Occhipinti, who is...
Herfurpados, yeah.
Herfurpados, incredible. I meant to bring it, actually. Forgot it. But Arianna Occhipinti is at all of our restaurants. So you have exciting winemakers who are making wine in a natural style, who are making balanced wines from native grapes, and that's just so exciting.
Can you actually explain the importance of organic, biodynamic, and natural in winemaking? Quickly, because this is like... Yeah. You're giving the best... What are those called? Those chat books where you don't want to read the whole book and you just want to, cliff notes for people that are interested in wines right now.
Right, sure. I mean, if we were talking pre-industrial revolution, none of those terms existed. When the industrial revolution happened, people found that working in the fields was no longer profitable. I mean, I don't think it ever was, a great way to make a living, but they found that they can make more money working in factories. So they left the fields in masses, and the people who were left working in the fields had to tend the vines with less manpower. So they also quickly were able to create machines and chemicals to help them speed those things along. Fast forward to today, I mean, there's a movement to go back to the way that things were made before all of this modern technology. And there are producers who want to make wine without chemicals at all, who want to make wine with the minimal intervention. What's really crazy is that if you look at the back of a wine label, there are no ingredients, but there are hundreds of approved ingredients that you're allowed to add to manipulate wine. So when you say that a wine is natural, it's not a term that can be certified like organic and biodynamic. You can get a certification, say that this, according to some board, is officially certified. But it implies a wine that has fewer and fewer of those added ingredients that are allowed to be added, whether it's enzymes or acids or alcohols or anything, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. There's all sorts of things that you're allowed to add and ways that you can manipulate wine. So wines are made in a natural way, are made in the most hands-off style.
Yeah, and when you taste a natural wine, all those things you were just mentioning, enzymes and fungi, all those notes, all those flavors, they can happen naturally. And, the manipulation, I think, loses whatever inherent qualities the wine should have.
I mean, you're so right. Everything that you need to make wine exists on the grape. Wine was made long before, before any of these chemicals are allowed to be added to wine were ever invented. And for me, what's really exciting is when a wine is really specific. That's why I really like wines like this Calabretta Etna Rosso, because it has this earthy volcanic character. It just reminds me so much of Mount Etna. And even if I've never been to Mount Etna, it's a wine that's so specific to that place that it can't be made anywhere else in the entire world. There are ways that you can manipulate wine so that they can taste very, very similar. They can be made anywhere. And this isn't one of them.
Yeah, well, I've been there, and it brings me back the instant you smell it and sip it. Like you said, the volcanic soils, the slight leatheriness, a little bit of that Choward's violet almost that come on through. It's that funny recall that you have. It's not like I drank wine when I was a little kid eating those kind of candies, but this just tastes like, your grandmother, coming down in her pedalinos, handing over this crazy bottle of wine that you get to enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right on that. You know, we live in New York City and use all the social media, and we're broadcasting out to people right now. And I think that with wine, you have an opportunity to connect with someone on the other side of the world. And if they're not manipulating the product at all, and they're making a really true and real and honest product, it brings you closer to that person and to their hard work. Someone on the other side of the world on an active volcano that could erupt at any moment 12 years ago, like, picked these grapes, and because they did it in a really natural way, you can really taste that place, and I think in a way kind of connect with those people.
Well, I think a lot of people can come connect with you at Del Anima, their 2C, and 4, and the new one.
And La Picho, the new one.
La Picho. And
coming soon.
Crazy wine list there, too.
Crazy. Oh, my God. Crazy yeah. Wines all the time. No. Yeah, there'll be a really good wine list.
Fantastic. I had no doubt. Thank you, Joe, for being on. And what a tasting to do. Now I understand why they do tastings at 10 a.m. at NYU. Very, very smart.
And I'm going to go eat a pizza at Roberto's now.
Excellent. Joe Campanelli, thank you so much. Visit one of his many restaurants, and there will always be more to come. Drink plenty of wine. What are you drinking tonight?
What am I drinking tonight? I'm probably going to drink more of that Greek rosé. That goes down easy.
Yeah, check out that bottle. It's beautiful. But you've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Durkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Salud.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.